Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, the Bishop of Aleppo, Syria, calls on Western powers to push for dialogue, not arms, to stop what he calls the fratricidal war in his country. Rethinking what makes peace in Lebanon, ahead of Pope Benedict's September trip to Beirut, we talk to the editor of a new report on conflict resolution and reconciliation in a nation whose civil war wounds have yet to fully heal. And lions and tigers and bears, oh my! A new game for kids and adults alike gives a new twist to new evangelization. The Greek Melkite Catholic Archbishop of Aleppo is calling on Western powers to promote dialogue for an end to the ongoing conflict in Syria. Metropolitan Archbishop Jean-Clément Jambard spoke to me just days before his office in Syria's biggest commercial city was ransacked by unidentified men. He said he and other church leaders have called on Syria's Christians to refrain from taking up weapons themselves and to work together with local Muslims to find a way out of the conflict.
Our places are not militarized, and we have forbidden and asked our people not to take arms and to stay away. And we made it clear to everybody that we are not part of this fighting. And we ask everybody to be quiet. And we remind everybody that we have been living with Muslims since hundreds of years, since centuries. And we have always been good with them, and they were good with us. But the people coming from other countries who do not know how the living together of Muslims and Christians in this part of the world was, they think that the thing is not good, and they are doing mistakes in this regard, and they may be killing some time. And we look forward, and we call for dialogue, and we call for finding a peaceful settlement for this problem. We call our people to do it, to try to work for it. We call our friends, Muslims friends, to try to work for it. But we must say that we'd like to see European countries, the Occidental world, doing something on that regard, to try not to send arms and push people to fight, but to send encouragement to sit down on a table and to talk and to find a solution by dialogue. That's what the Holy Father has called several times, and we are happy, and we are proud to know that our Pope Benedictus has called for that. And this is very important. The Western countries must understand that it is not the way to get what he wants. The peace and the dialogue will be the best way to find the issue for this. Yes, this fratricide war, where people dies for nothing, but for realizing some objectives, I do not understand.
One of the things that came out of the Synod of Bishops for the Middle East in 2010
yes.
was the fact that the bishops are very concerned about the exodus of Christians from the Middle East. They've been there for 2,000 years.
That's right. And this is our big problem, and this is what we suffer, actually. What we suffer, what I suffer myself and all my brothers, bishops, are suffering, is that many people want to leave, and mostly the youth, and this is a big preoccupation for us. Many people has left, those who had some possibility, financial possibilities and money, they were able to go to Lebanon and to other countries to stay for a few months to see what how things will go. But some of them has left to Canada and to Australia and to Europe, and this is for us a big preoccupation. Some organization here are, of course, they are not recognized, but some business offices are offering to some of our people the transfer to Sweden or other countries, paying a lot of money. They let them pass to Turkey, and they make for them false documents, and they bring them there. And when they arrive, they declare that they are political refugees. And this is a bad thing. I don't like it. There are others who try to fly and to go to emigrate legal and regular ways. There are those who have some relatives in the United States or in Canada or in Australia or in South America. But this phenomenon of exodus is terrible, and we are very, very, very aware about it and preoccupied.
Metropolitan Archbishop Jean-Clément Jambard, the Archbishop of the Greek Melkite Catholic Church of Aleppo. The UK-based peace and reconciliation think tank Conciliation Resources is calling for a review of peace initiatives in Lebanon. Bordering on Syria and Israel, the country has repeatedly been drawn into regional conflicts and is still recovering from 17 years of a civil war, which formally ended with the Taif Agreement in 1989. Recent clashes in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli testify as to just how easily a conflict like the one now in Syria can have repercussions on its smaller neighbor. While Conciliation Resources focuses on 7 conflict-affected regions around the world, taking an in-depth look at specific conflict and peace-building themes through their Accord serial publications. The latest report in the Accord series, Reconciliation, Reform, and Resilience, Positive Peace for Lebanon, suggests a fundamentally different approach is needed to transform negative and precarious stability in Lebanon into positive and resilient peace. A wide range of representatives from different sectors of Lebanese society, plus experts from outside the country, contributed to the report. Accord editor Alexander Ramsbottom says most of the Accord projects are more than a year and a half in the making, and information for its publication on Lebanon was gathered before an upsurge in Lebanon of violence related to the Syrian conflict. Ramsbottom notes that researchers found that one of the biggest challenges to any sustainable peace in Lebanon is what they call the country's collective amnesia regarding the past.
Certainly that was a viewpoint that we felt was very significant. In fact, we had a whole section of the publication focusing on reconciliation and in particular dealing with the past. And we felt that there were a lot of problems that have carried on from the civil war up to today, and a lot of tensions within society which have failed to be dealt with because there hasn't been enough or the right type of focus put on reconciliation at a number of levels, from the local level all the way up to the national level. And a particular blockage to reconciliation going forwards was this very deliberate and quite widespread decision, really, to say, well, we'll forget about what happened in the past and we won't address it and we'll just move on from there. And this is epitomized, I guess, in the Amnesty Law 1991, which very explicitly said that they wouldn't try to address some of the crimes and other things that happened during the war. And meanwhile, there's been no sense of collective, at least at the national level, thinking about, well, what happened, who did what to whom, and how can we try to move on from that and get people to talk to each other and have a dialogue about how they might reconcile some of their differences and their problems and remember some of the things that happened.
Now, it's interesting that you should say that. I've often wondered if a peace and reconciliation commission or a process similar to what was set up after the apartheid era in South Africa would be a viable solution to Lebanon's problems. Did your researchers find that something like that process would be a cathartic exercise for the country?
We didn't make specific recommendations about whether a similar process from, as you mentioned, in South Africa, but also we've seen in other parts of Africa and actually more increasingly across the Middle East today. What we did suggest was that, first off, that there are quite a few civil society efforts to promote memorialization, remembering the past, but also to look at issues of reconciliation. For example, we did a feature on a place called Umam, which is based in Beirut, which has been documenting and collecting people's memories of the war and their experiences of it across a massively wide range of different sectors of society and different people who are involved in different ways, from militia fighters through to villagers and so forth. And so there are a lot of initiatives to try to deal with the past. However, one of the things that we found, or our researchers found rather, was that a lot of these quite often stay within Beirut, and not only within Beirut, at a quite a sort of elite social level within Beirut. They're tied up with the arts and different things that happen on that sort of level, which isn't to criticize that happening. There are amazing things going on. But what they fail to do is reach out to sort of, to society as a whole, sort of lower levels of society like that within Beirut, but also across the country. And actually, there are local structures and traditional structures for conflict resolution and different types of activity that happen at a local level, which could be tapped into to spread these types of memorialization across the country and throughout society, which would be a really big catalyst, I think, for reconciliation to take place.
So you say that most of these people are young people working out of Beirut, but they need to spread their efforts more widely across the country. But many of the young people today would not have lived through the 17-year civil war that gripped the country, as you said, up until about 1989. So how can these young people today be engaged more in this dialogue for peace? I mean, were you able to come up with some suggestions of how the people there in Beirut are able to reach out?
Yes, no, we did quite a lot of stuff on youth issues. And I think a starting point for us was the real tragic situation for Lebanon is, as you say, today's youth haven't experienced the war and would hope to be living in a reconciled society that was had moved on somewhere from the war. In fact, that isn't what it looks like, really, for many Lebanese youth today. They face a lot of challenges, from economic challenges, employment and unemployment, and also social challenges to do with which particular type of group you belong to and what that means for your opportunities. And in fact, today there's, I think, a lot of youth are actually leaving Lebanon, a lot of very qualified youth. They work to get their qualifications and then they look beyond Lebanon to progress in their lives because of the lack of opportunities domestically, which is a real shame and is a real problem. Another problem, or which might be tied to an opportunity for change, is to do with voting rights, because voting rights are still set at the age of 21 in Lebanon. And there have been recommendations from a number of studies and from a number of different areas to bring that down to 18, but that's still quite resisted in many parts of the political system. External pressures like we see at the moment from particularly what's happening in Syria, those have really been recurrent since the end of the civil war, and Lebanon has found itself repeatedly vulnerable to these external challenges. But we were saying that the reason it's so vulnerable is because of internal weakness and the types of cleavage that I've just spoken about.
Lebanon is often characterized as a pawn in a game of regional chess. To what extent is Lebanon responsible for its own fate?
That's a very good question and a very big question for us. We have called this publication Positive Peace for Lebanon, Reconciliation, Reform, and Resilience. And the second part of that, reconciliation, reform, and resilience, refers to social reconciliation between different societal groups within Lebanon, reform of the political system. And then it's really Lebanon's national resilience, and that really refers to its ability to withstand these types of external pressure. So we very much acknowledge the fact that Lebanon is in a difficult regional position and there are very significant external pressures which are undeniable. A key point for us was, however, that it was the domestic situation is the key to progress, and it's Lebanon's internal weakness, which is that the primary cause for its vulnerability to these external pressures.
Pope Benedict will be visiting Lebanon September 14th through 16th. Just in view of that visit, I wanted to ask you, religion often seems to get the short end of the stick and is often blamed for many of the world's problems. But can't it be part of the solution, and particularly there in the Middle East?
Well, it exists there anyway, and it's a massive social and political focus for different social groups in the Middle East and in Lebanon in particular. So whether you think it's a part of the problem or a part of the solution, it's not going to go away, so you have to deal with it. Certainly, in a positive sense, we, in our study, we had a section looking at interfaith dialogue within the Lebanese situation, which has transformed over years from a sort of Christian-Muslim dialogue to a sort of Sunni-Shia dialogue with Christians attached to it. So it has morphed quite a bit in the Lebanon situation. But there's certainly a lot happening on the ground in Lebanon to promote interfaith dialogue, which I think can have a very big impact on what's going on. And there's the person we speak to is the Secretary General of the Committee for Islamic Christian Dialogue, Mohammed Samak. And he makes some very specific references to what has happened in the past, what sort of activities they've done, whether interfaith dialogue is becoming more difficult or easier in the current sort of situation, and the types of impact it might be able to have. So there's certainly lots of positive things happening, and there are ways that people are trying to make religion part of the solution, as you suggested, rather than part of the problem. There's always also a dialogue on question of secularization in Lebanon, particularly at the political level, which is a whole other debate, which doesn't necessarily dismiss the idea of religion or the role of religion in society or in relation to the state. But it's important to take all those factors into consideration when you're thinking about these types of issues.
And thanks there to Accord editor Alexander Ramsbottom from Conciliation Resources. It's new evangelization, Aussie style, as we approach the October Synod on New Evangelization, and local churches worldwide have been submitting their thoughts, opinions, and ideas on how new evangelization can be enacted on a pastoral and practical level. Four ordinary dads from Queensland, Australia, have gone one step further. They have produced a fun-packed, family-sized tool for evangelization, in the form of one of the most popular family activities worldwide, the board game. Emer McCarthy has the story.
We've been working very hard over the last 7 years to develop a new resource for Christians to help them reach out and connect with children and teenagers, and we've based it on a board game of a very well-known story from the Bible, the one of Noah and the Ark.
Hello, this is Noah, and welcome to Ark, the Great Race.
Peter Maynard is one of the young, hard-working fathers who, in his spare time, worries about how to bring children and teenagers to God. He dropped by Vatican Radio this summer, fresh from a meeting at the Vatican Council for New Evangelization, with a shiny red box tucked under his arm. I was curious, and I wanted to see what was in the box and what it had to do with evangelization. And as he opened it up, unfolding the multicolored board, I was brought back to when I was 12 years old. And the more he spoke about the game, the more I wanted to play.
So let's not waste any more time. Let's get started, shall we?
Now, I have it in front of me, and it looks like any other typical board game that you would find on the market today. It really is fantastic quality design, beautiful colours, and it's basically the world. It's a map of the world with these paths.
Absolutely.
Etched out in it.
And on top of that, there's 49 different animals from 7 different regions around the world. And the objective of the game is to race around the world, going through as many different continents as you can, and collecting as many pairs of animals and keeping them safely in your ark.
Whoa, I've got a giant panda!
So cool. Wow, that's awesome.
But as you move along the board, you'll notice there's certain rainbow icons, And they're mystery spots, some good, some bad. Your art can hit an iceberg and all of a sudden break apart and letting all your animals escape.
And you have to start again.
You've got to start again. Or someone else can take your animals if they guess the right animal that you have. So there's a lot of excitement to it. The great thing about the game, though, is anyone can win the game right up to the last roll of the dice.
So it's a good old typical traditional dice board game, which is always a favourite among...
Absolutely.
Among not only children, but also families.
Definitely. And we play the as adults, we play the game a lot. And we get a lot of fun out of it. It's a great game.
Now, you also, as well as the rainbow icons, have these squares or places. Well, they're not actually squares, they're circles, but places on the paths that have question marks.
Absolutely. And these tend to favour the kids a bit more than the adults, because when you land on these particular spots, you can guess, you can try and guess a card or an animal that another player has got. And if you guess the correct animal, you win that card. So the more you can remember of what people have around the game, the more chance you have of collecting more animals.
Because you get to see the animals that they collect.
When they pick a card up for the first time by landing on one of these coloured spots, they have to tell everyone what sort of animal they just picked up. So, for example, if I land on a purple and I pick up a purple card, I have a boa constrictor. So I would tell everyone that. And if you can remember that, when you land on a purple, on a question mark spot, you can win that card by guessing that animal.
And if you've got two cards of the same animal?
Yes, if you have either a pair card where the animal is a pair, or you have a female and a male of that animal, they can go into your arc and then no one can steal them when they land on the question mark spots.
So where do we start from? We start in what part of the world?
Each player starts from their own start pontoon in the corner of the map. Mm-hmm. And there's six people can play the game. And you basically just follow the direction of the board around, trying to travel through as many different regions as you can.
Are the animals divided up according to their natural region?
Absolutely,
and habitat?
Absolutely. So there's a good educational component there. All the animals of Europe will be represented from Asia, Australia. Not all the animals, but a nice selection of probably the more common animals.
And have you tested this out on the market yet?
Absolutely, and it's been a big hit with adults and with children. Everyone that's played it has really enjoyed the fact that you do have that chance to win the game right up to the end. You're not knocked out at any particular time of the game. And also on top of that, there's a great educational component. One of the things that we've noticed too is that it's a game of memory, so that the kids have a really good chance against the adults. It's a good levelling field.
Now all that's left is to win the race. Remember, to win the game, you need to be the player with the most pairs of animals from the most coloured regions in a completed arc when your timer goes off.
But before players begin their journey of the world, they have to read the instructions for use. The original story of Noah and the Ark. Because, as Maynard points out, it's not just about family entertainment.
And giving Christians the opportunity to reach out to people through positive experiences. So getting together and playing a game based on a Bible story was an excellent opportunity for us to introduce someone to the Bible story, and then also a message at the end that they can reach out if they want to know more about God.
This is really a tool for new evangelization, isn't it?
That's exactly what we've looked for. As the inventors of the game are four Christian guys with four families and kids, and we see that one of the biggest tasks before us is bringing children and teenagers to God. We were fortunate enough to have had that experience. We wanted to find ways to not only tell other Christians to go and do it, but give them a resource to help them go and do it. And that's what the board game is for us, and that's what it is for all Christians out there.
Vital in new evangelization, the role of the family, isn't it? Sometimes it's overlooked. We all think, oh, we'll just leave the priest to do that. We'll just leave the bishop to take care of that.
Absolutely. And for me, I think it's the core. I think once we have been blessed with an understanding of what's been provided for us, it's our responsibility to let other people know about that. And that's a lot of the times easier said than done. I know I've struggled myself. How do I start a conversation? It's one thing to lead by example, but that doesn't actually deliver a message. And the great thing about the game was that we could bring families together, we can give families a resource that is a positive experience, that is a great segue into a conversation. And then when all the pieces come together, the leading by example, oh, here's a message, this is what's behind this person, it might all come together and they say, well, I want to know more about this. And for me, I think that's the best way I can contribute.
But this is only one story from the Old Testament.
Absolutely.
There are more.
There are more, and there is another game in progress. This game is Noah, is Ark the Great Race, and the next game that's in store is Exodus the Great Escape.
And, of course, you brought it out in a country, Australia, which is very secular in nature. So how was it? What was the reaction to the game over there?
It's always a challenge. I think a lot of the time you just need to stand by what you believe in and demonstrate what you believe in. And the game, whether or not it's taken as being a Christian game or not, is really up to the individual. What we're trying to do is to provide a resource and to provide an experience that gives an opportunity to cut through. Australians can be tough to cut through to. There's no doubt about that. And it's become very evident to me while travelling through Europe, some of the advantages that exist by history in itself. There are so many monuments and landmarks that really cement Christianity as the core in Europe, and that's very evident to see. Australia being a new country, we don't necessarily have that. So we really have to fight the fight a different way, so to say. And that's what I think can bring out the best in Australians. We need to innovate and we need to look to find ways to do it differently. And I think sometimes that's our best offering. So hopefully, whilst it may be a success in countries where there is a very strong Christian culture, we really hope it has the same effect in Australia.
If any of our listeners want this,
yes,
know, they may be thinking, great birthday present, great Christmas present.
Yes.
How are they going to get it,
okay,
particularly those not living in Australia?
Absolutely. We have a very specific model behind the game. The game is not going to be sold through traditional commercial outlets. It's only going to be provided to not-for-profit organisations and churches. We want churches to use the tool, use the resource as a fundraising resource as well. So a church would come on as a partner, and they would sell directly to their congregation or their members, and they would receive all of the commercial profits instead of going to a commercial company. So the two wins out of it is that you're buying a Christian resource to use as an evangelical tool and an outreach tool, and at the same time, your church, your organisation are generating funds to continue with other work in the same area.
It's keeping it all local, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, community, family, that's where the strength is. And if we can build that up and make that stronger, the world will only be a better place.
Well, thank you very much. We wish you the best of luck, and you'll have to come back when the Exodus, the Great Escape, is ready.
We would love to.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Now things may begin to get a little crazy as time runs out and the thunderstorm begins. Remember, have lots of fun and good luck.
My thanks there to Peter Maynard from Queensland, one of the four Australian dads bringing new evangelisation one step closer to families. And if you want to find out more about the Ark, the Great Race, you can visit the website www.arkthegreatrace.com. I'm Emma McCarthy.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.